In 1996, I was running a small internet startup. In fact, we're proud to say we were one of the early failures. That was involved the idea of connecting journalists who are covering the high-tech market into communities to help filter news, because there was an average of 500, between 100 and 500 press releases in the high-tech industry per day. And it had overwhelmed people's ability, and they were, you know, what is good here? So I had to start researching online communities, and I fell into Howard Rheingold's Electric Minds community. And this was the first kind of open, commercially intended online community. And Howard Rheingold came from this community called The Well, had a deep knowledge about online community, incredibly smart guy, wide-ranging interests. If you want to read anything about online communities, read Howard Rheingold's Virtual Community, Homesteading on the Electronic Frontier. You can download it for free. So Howard goes, oh, Nancy, I know you've done offline community organizing, and oh, so-and-so, you know, I know you know a lot about technology. In other words, the soft, squishy process person and the geek. You guys figure out what to do. So he thought, well, I could program something, and I thought, I've done offline community organizing. This should be doable. We failed miserably. Miserably. Everything we tried created more division, more chaos. The fragmentation was enormous. So a part of the community succeeded in finding a new platform, succeeded in moving, and interestingly enough, that was the part of the community that was more interested in joking with each other than having deep conversations. What that means, I still don't know. So it helped me understand that facilitating online and offline was always evolving, and it was always an interplay with the environment. So you talk about the interplay of the environment where you put in commuters and they're ripped off the next day. Or the environment where some people have bandwidth, some people don't. Or the environment where you have people who will try any new tool under the sun, and the others who are loath to get off email because it took them a long time to get on email. And you've got this diversity always going on. So I needed some perspective to look at facilitation of communities. And more than facilitation, but the roles and the leadership. And I don't mean positional leadership necessarily. Sometimes it is. The act of helping with the technology when it's not working, that's an act of leadership. Putting the tape on the floor, pulling it up, deciding to jump up and help take notes, whatever it may be, taking a video and sharing it later. Those, to me, are all acts of leadership. And I needed a perspective to look at this stuff. So this is when I became more and more tight with this community of practice thing. So I thought, we've been throwing around the word community of practice, and it might be useful to define it or understand if we have a similar shared set of meaning of community practice. And then I'm going to step you outside of that, but still keep a community of practice perspective. The thing that I'd like to distinguish here from a communities of practice perspective is not that you need to define whether something is or isn't a community of practice. But a communities of practice perspective includes some very important elements, all of which are encapsulated in the words you've talked about here, which can be thought of as the three stools of a community of practice. And this is straight from Etienne Becker, okay? I bow down and I acknowledge my learning mentor is Etienne in this particular context. It's community, a group of people. I would say that in writing this book, we were first a community of practice and second doing a project together, because, and that's why it took 5.5 years, is because we were constantly learning and coming and going. We take our conversations, we take it out into our work, and our work is very diverse across the three of us. We see what happened and we bring it back and go, oh, let's change that. So, you know, that's why the books had like 4 versions before it ever got published. So a group of people, community. The first leg of the stool is there's a group of people. And one of the things, and when we thought about communities of practice in the past, we thought about a defined group of people we could name. Hold that thought, because that's something that's shifting. But you have to know who's in or who's out. You have to have a sense of the other people. You have to care about the other people to some degree. That doesn't mean you're best friends. But you recognize that Mike and I are in a community of practice, and when I have a question, I can go to Mike. And Mike will answer me, and there's that kind of, and it's more of a direct reciprocity, okay? Domain, what we care about, common interest, shared interest, purpose. It's what we care about. It's my domain is, you know, where are the best dark chocolate shops in North America or in any city that I visit. My domain may be about, there may also be, you know, some subdomains there that some people are interested in. So the people, what we care about, and then practice. And practice actually shows up in a lot of different things here. And when we have interest and purpose, but we have intent, intent is a trigger for practice. You know, but you have to actually get there. You can't just intend there. You have to do it. So someone said, talk about what they do and do it better. the talking about what you do is the practice, and the doing it better is part of the practice. And practice is actually one of the more interesting things to try and put your finger on, because it you know, it's what the community does together, and it's what they do with what they've done together. So it has these two meanings, the internal meaning of practice and the external meaning of practice. So when we think about a communities of practice perspective, I don't care whether something is a community of practice or not. I care about how does community show up, how does domain show up, and how does practice show up. And that gets us out of the semantic trap of saying, well, if it was formal, if it was declared by someone from top down, it's not a community, because there's a whole dialectic around that. I'm not going to go there, because from a facilitation standpoint, we want to pay attention to what's relevant in any particular context. And the CPD framework gives us a way to look at and evaluate our community with some language, but without getting stuck into all the other things around that are different in communities. Does that make sense? So CPD is a facilitation and leadership framework, right there. If I pay attention to community, domain, and practice, I'm having a way to talk about, to look at, evaluate, negotiate with my community what's going on. Here's a tip from Etienne, is never mess with C all three at once. Don't mess with CPD at once, because you will destabilize your community incredibly. So mess with one at a time. Now, the exception is when you either need to blow up your community because it's gone, you know. Well, you know, it's either do or die, and then you might want to mess with CPD. So, you know, but generally people can't cope with you messing with all one. But domains change over time. The community makeup changes over time, and certainly the practice changes over time. And if it stays static, then you may want to think twice. Maybe it's not alive anymore. So that's what I mean by a community of practice perspective. Okay. So when the original community practice research was done, it was talking about bounded groups. A group of midwives in the Yucatan, tailors in Aegis, insurance adjusters in Canada within a particular company. So what we've noticed, and what we really noticed through the research here, is those boundaries have been broken down. So I'd like to suggest that sometimes we are not talking about communities, and we as facilitators / leaders or whatever, maybe the people to raise their hand and say, you know, maybe we don't want a community of practice. No, maybe we need something else. So there's this continuum that exists. The second piece of this continuum is, you know, they say interesting things happen at the boundaries and the borders. As I unfold this continuum, think about the space in between them. So personal learning environment is focus everything on making it around the student or the learner. And that could be a learner in a company. It could be a learner in a classroom. It doesn't really matter. We can take the learner as a very broad category. Make it so they can customize everything that's important for them. It's the focus on the individual. We've had people talk about unschooling, where people simply go out to the internet and find what they need. They go out to their physical community, they find what they need. They go out and get what they need. And that can be a very solitary thing, or it could be a very social thing. But going solo is really showing up a lot in a lot of environments. In corporate training, it's, you know, just-in-time personal learning. Small groups are very powerful because they're adaptable. People can move around more quickly and more agilely. You don't have to negotiate with a whole group of people. And in both those cases, the pairs and the triads can be very effective strategies. For the externally facing, it can give people a handhold in a wide-open network where they could never get to know anybody. And in an internal facing thing, it can give them flexibility that the institution itself may not give. So thinking about small groups is very powerful. Often we have not designed our interfaces so that small groups can form and that they can be close to each other and cross over with each other. Because when small groups intersect, they can focus. They're not overwhelmed informationally, relationally, but then they can see what the next group is going. So just a little telegraphing out from the small groups, and then you as facilitator can weave those across so they can get the benefit of both small and large groups. So multiple small groups can scale out to more successful large groups sometimes than a single large group. So there's a strategy in thinking about the space in between. The next is the group, and group of people who, it's a bounded group. So they're all moving in the same direction, and I think the thing that really characterizes the move from the individual to the group for me is that I give up a little bit of the me for the we. So that would be the criteria. So finally, we have the network, and this is the form that is most changed by internet technology, which is that we can connect with people anywhere there is a connection. So if there's an internet connection, we can connect with people. We can have all kinds of intersections that are light or heavy. And this gives us access to diversity and can possibly overwhelm us. So an interesting tension. Barry Wellman talks about network individualism. So this is the thing that connects the network back to the individual. If we think about how we participate in the network, it can be very solo. It can be very individual. And when we create networks, we have to think is, do we want to create points where people can find each other and move into those more intense relationships and perhaps shift to community or shift to parent triad? And in our close communities, when we have people who have outgrown the community, do we have a network we can boot them out to, where they can carry our learnings out to the wider world, where we can find new members? So the space between them, how can these forms complement each other? So just briefly, I want to talk a little bit about some of the defining elements of these things along the continuum. But again, don't think of them with the hard stuff, because even me, the individual, if they're actively participating in the network, have transcended the boundary of one single person. If you think about learning theories, often identity is a dangerous part of a flip chart. An important part of how people see themselves in the world affects how they take in or relate to the world. So, you know, when I'm simply looking out for me, it's my own needs, my own personal trajectory. I'm not really thinking about the wider community or society around me. With communities, it's you know who's in or you know who's out. This idea of joining, initiation into a community, how do you onboard people? One of the really important facilitation aspects in a community is onboarding people, bringing them in, helping them understand the language, the ways of the community. It might be also how you kick them out. I'm not really joking about kicking out, because from a facilitation standpoint, there's this time when people outgrow communities because the boundary actually is too constraining for them. The network is boundaryless. You can't really tell where the beginning, the middle, and the end is. And interestingly enough, with communities, our relationships are personal. Like, I get to know you before I trust you. And once I trust you, well, then we can do cool things together. In the network, we often are attracted to people because of content. And if you're interested in this from a theoretical standpoint, and those of you guys doing research back, look at Uri Engstrom's work. That's the younger, not the elder. Okay. If you look for Engstrom, there's two Engstroms. Look for the younger Engstrom. And look for his work around object-centered sociality. I have a very difficult time saying that without looking at the words. It's sort of a tongue twister. Object-centered sociality. And I have noticed that people will trust people around content. So if I read your blog, and I really liked your blog, I'd keep reading your blog. And pretty soon I'd start referring to stuff I learned from your blog without ever getting to know you. Now, it's a possibility that I might send an email, or we get going back and comment, and we might get to know each other. And then I'd find out that you also like chocolate, and that you live in a certain neighborhood, things that we use to establish relationship in face-to-face communities. But we started with an object, not with personal relationship. And for those of us of older generations, this is somewhat startling, because we have built a lot of our cultural and social norms around, hi, I'm Nancy, you know, let's get to know each other, let's sit and have a coffee. You know, we see each other at 4 or 5 meetings, and then we're ready to, you know, I remember our conversation. And then we start getting into it. In the network, this is a significant difference. We connect around content. So when people say community is all about the people, they want to say the network is all about the content. But that may be the case. So this has implications about how we use content to attract people, to engage people, and how they create content that attracts and engages people. So it's not about us putting up a portal of all the great resources for teachers. It's about how can we create a space where people can share their content. And therefore, they can connect in the network as well as the community. So content is this lovely little linkage. If you're interested in this idea of blogs and how they can form around community, look at the work of Lilia Efimova. And she's written about, she started writing about blogs in the workplace, but she's actually looked at the formations and how the relationship formations happen in blogs. And there's some interesting work around the difference of community formation via blogs versus a discussion board, for example. So the tool here is an interesting implication of how the community does or doesn't form. So, and now when we see the introduction of Twitter, we see network-like behavior and we see community-like behavior. Because people who only follow small, tight groups of people and lots of reciprocity or shared, you know, following, versus the people who follow thousands of people, but they're looking for signals across all that diversity. So that's a very network-like behavior. So Twitter can support both community behavior, network behavior, or you could use it as a very me-centered thing. It's just simply looking for what you want and not contributing. So, you know, you know, me could mean not contributing. This is where some of the interesting cultural, socioeconomic, what's the other word I'm looking for? We'll say cultural and social aspects and the diversity that happens across there. If I am not a self-motivated learner, I'm not going to be a really good solo learner. What we notice, though, in communities is that the power dynamics are much more clear. A facilitator can actually influence a community far more than they can influence a network. One person can screw up a community, one person can block a community. In networks, people flow around those blockages. So if you're trying to control something, you don't want a network, because you're not going to control it. So if you have to have control, you want to think about a community form versus a network form. But at the same time, a community doesn't usually scale because often they're around hub and spoke. The key role of the convener, the facilitator, the leader, when that goes away, the community can die. And also we cannot handle so many relationships. You think about, it's called Dunbar's number, which says we can manage about 150 relationships. So if I want to facilitate for scale, I want to go down here. If I want to facilitate for focus and for outcome. You know, it's hard to facilitate a network to build a widget. The network can come up with all kinds of ways of building the widget. They can come up with unique approaches to building that widget. They can do a critique of that widget. But do they get the widget done? Generally, it's something that falls out of that network into a team. A team definition is a group of people with interdependent tasks and a shared outcome. Community, you know, may be more shared interests, but a team has something they have to create. So we want to facilitate action often comes into the smaller form, or even that pair or dyad, or the dyad or triad. But if we want to open up, bring new ideas, create new relationships, scale ideas, so the idea of a viral movement, you want to think about a network. And often we are thinking about externally facing quote-unquote communities. What we're doing is trying to make content available where people, and you can correct my assumption as soon as I'm finished, because I'm sure I've gotten this thing. When people aggregate around events, they find each other, and they may create their own community within the network that you're offering. But the number of people you want to reach will never be able to be in the entire community with each other by the definition I shared, which is bound membership where people know each other. Community, just like best practices, is one of those abused, overused, misunderstood words, and we mean lots of different things, and we use it very cavalierly and loosely, but we mean it great deal of intent. If Jose Cuervo is really smart, they understand that it's not just about their brand, it's about their association to something that's valued in the community with their brand. And that is a useful externally facing strategy. We also see externally facing communities trying to jam something down people's throats, just promoting the same marketing they're doing through everything else, and it is not community, nor is it network. So along the continuum of commercial communities, you'll see everything. Along the success of internal communities, you'll see everything. But the idea here in this purpose exercise, and I think we'll probably draw it to a close now, is twofold. One is to examine your purpose along that continuum of me, we, and the network. And think, indeed, am I aiming for a community or not? And if I'm really not, then I need to think about different facilitation strategies. So you came here to talk about community facilitation strategies, and I would like to say perhaps not. Perhaps not. Perhaps you want to be facilitating individuals, perhaps you want to be facilitating communities, and perhaps you want to be facilitating networks, or some combination thereof. So I'd say the larger and broader your project, and some of you have, you know, purpose statements here that could include a very broad domain and a very broad group of constituents, maybe underneath that big network umbrella, you might think of two or three initial communities that you focus on, and you grow out to the network. Or you create the network-enabling environment so that the communities fall out of it, and they'll tell you what's important, and they'll determine where their focus is. Often community is being done unto people without their consent, without their interest, without their ability to know how to participate. But when you think of these different doorways, the individual, the group, and the network, you may be able to facilitate engagement in ways that a single one or the one you were using, you might be able to engage the most, just really poor English. And you know I said there's sometimes no firm boundary between community and network? As communities grow, we lose the ability to know who's in, who's out, and pretty soon they start forming sub-communities. And pretty soon the overall structure is network-like, so it's and it can go in both directions. Congruency or overlap. In a community, there's a greater likelihood that, and I'm using this lightly, everybody knows everybody. I might not hang out with you because we're not quite the same, and I may really want to hang out with you, but I know that you're both in the community. In a network, what we have is a lot of intersections. So a lot of people know a lot of people, but they all don't know the same people. And that creates a different dynamic in terms of how information or knowledge flows, about how relationships are formed and are abandoned. This goes to the idea of loose ties, a network theory, Mark Granovetter, and so I've met you twice face-to-face. We've interacted online. We've had some fairly significant conversations. So I'd say we have more than a loose tie, but we don't have like this the tight tie that I have with the person that I'm working with on a daily basis. But I can call upon you because I know you. But I can also call upon you as a member of Tony's network. We should not idealize community. That's a big mistake. So first of all, this idea that community is happy, that it's agreement, that it's even homogeneous, is not necessarily true. But I think maybe, let me try this out, is if we're distinguishing between meaningful connection with another human being, I think communication is the thread that allows the connection to happen. Because communication happens in the network. It may happen in an impersonal way or a personal way. It may happen around content or it may happen around relationship. In community, there's something shared, and that can be controlling and dysfunctional, or it can be safe. You know, when you think about, I work with a community of women who are survivors of domestic violence. They need privacy. They need to be inward-facing because, A, they don't want to broadcast their presence to their ex-partners who would hurt them, okay? They need to be able to speak anything in the safety of that boundary. That's the case where community provides a boundary that enables the type of participation that is needed for that group of people. A group of people trying to understand how to promote urban gardening so that people would start growing their own little bits of food really wants to be outward facing. So there may be a community of activists, and they support each other. They may do it very openly. You may have total access to their community, because they call it the large community, but it's actually the core of a network, or one of the cores of a network. So they do a lot of coordination, but who they want to really impact is outside. Therefore, their boundary is completely transparent, and they use the network to disseminate, to connect. So they're connecting in ways that those loose ties may become very tight and they may become loose again. So the line between those two, I can't draw it. I used to be able to draw it. Technology has changed what it means between that continuum. And I think also some groups are coming and going. So my home community is Knowledge Management for Development. There are now 800 members scattered around the world, many who come from different cultural and linguistic backgrounds. There's a core of that that is really the community. They read almost all the messages. They reply often. They participate in the leadership and facilitation of the community. But the network doesn't see itself. Most of the people never participate. They never post a message. They may read 1% of the messages. They may come in for one resource that made a difference. But they carry that out and affect their communities. And what we've noticed when we actually follow down and ask members, and, you know, contact them personally, not just send out some another survey that they have to fill out, is, oh yeah, this is a really valuable thing for me. You've never posted, we don't know who you are, and the barrier to membership here is you sign up for the email list. It's that easy. There's, you know, that's a network, and within it there's the core community, within it there's the European subgroup, within it there's this. So there's all of these things that emerge within it, and it's constantly in flux. People come and go. What do I call it? How do I think about its growth, its emergence, its facilitation? There's a whole spectrum of things we need to pay attention to. When it was a group of 150 people, it was a completely different day. Just because it helps us focus down to the issues we're talking about designing and facilitating, you know, groups of people with a particular intent. And what is our approach to it? And when you think about a network, it scales, but it scales beyond your influence as a facilitator quickly. A community has some... You have some ability to have some influence on it. And sometimes you want that influence, and sometimes that influence is not useful. And, you know, you can only facilitate so far. But in networks, you create conditions for things to happen, and things emerge in that network.
So they're out of your control. Now, that we think communities are in our control is also self-delusional, so I'll put that on there. But I think also, as we struggle with these words, it's not to diminish human connection of any form, and people have significant human connection in all those forms, including sometimes just with themselves. One thing I just want to bring up here before I forget, which you also bring up the concept of legitimate peripheral participation, which is the lurker or the person who sits at the periphery of the community and has a meaningful experience, a useful experience. Are they having a network experience or a community experience? You could argue either way, but it's an important part of it, and it's why that boundary is not so clear. And I also appreciate this idea that I'm not saying that the human part is impractical. When I try and talk about the practice of facilitation in communities of practice, I need to have some sort of language to define the context I'm working on so that you and I can understand what we're talking about. It's a limited language, but I need a starting point. I need an affordance, a handle, so that we can start figuring out the differences and similarities across these forms.